let's go back to where we left off last week, which was Romans 2, Israel in the wilderness, D at Sinai, Exodus 19, the numbers 10, 10, and then under D, we were at 1E. One is the establishment of the Sinai covenant, and E is the book of the covenant. Remember, we talked about the book of the covenant being the application of the foundational law, the Ten Commandments, to more specific types of legal cases. And we looked at some examples of that. Maybe that wasn't toward the end of that discussion, but in the course of that discussion, I mentioned that there are other ancient Near Eastern law codes in existence that have been excavated, translated, published, so that you can read these law codes. I've listed five of them there, all of which you notice predate the time of Moses. Now, we talked about the date of the Exodus, which is really a way to get at the date of Moses, depending on whether you have an early date view or a late date view. Moses would be 1400 or 1200. Well, if you look at the dates of those law codes, they run from 2000 down to 1500. So there are five law codes that are demonstrably earlier in time than what you might call the covenant code in Exodus 20 to 23. And then what we did last week, we looked at one example of a comparison of a law from the covenant code to one of the laws of the laws of Eshnunna, and that is this matter of ox gore, and particularly verse 5 of Exodus 21, verse 35 of Exodus 21, compared with law 53 of the code of the laws of Eshnunna, is almost identical. The wording is a little bit different, but the way in which the problem of ox gore there is treated is certainly identical. That, I mentioned towards the end of our last session, raises the question of what is the relationship between the formulations of the laws in the covenant code of Exodus 20 to 23 with the formulation of laws in the ancient Near Eastern law codes. And right towards the end of the hour, I've suggested that I don't think there's any reason to conclude that it's not possible that the Lord took up into the formulation of the laws of the Book of the Covenant Moses' awareness, knowledge, familiarity with the legal traditions of the time. If you go back, as I mentioned, to Exodus 18:16, where Moses meets his father-in-law Jethro in the wilderness, and Jethro gives him the advice to appoint judges over thousands, hundreds, and so forth groups, and only the hard cases come to Moses. You read in verse 16 of Exodus 18, Moses says, whenever they have a dispute, it's brought to me, I decide between the parties, and inform them of God's decrees and laws. There's Moses informing Israel of God's decrees and laws before Sinai. And whatever way in which he did that, it seems to me it's quite probable, similar thing going on in the formulation of the laws of the Book of the Covenant. So when you read in Exodus 21:1, these are the laws you are set before them. It seems to me that what that is telling us is these laws have divine sanction. And the Lord is giving them to Israel through Moses, and in that process, taking up into their formulation what Moses' knowledge of the legal tradition of his time. Now, having said that, that does not mean, as some have attempted to argue, that the biblical material is simply borrowed from some of these other ancient law codes. I think if you look closely, you'll find there are a lot of differences between the Book of the Covenant and the ancient Near Eastern law codes. go through some of those differences. If you look at your citations, page 24, there's some paragraphs there from a volume called Themes in Old Testament Theology, written by William Durness. In Durness's discussion of the Book of the Covenant, he points out that there are many ways in which the legal material of the Book of the Covenant is far superior to what you find in these other ancient biblical law codes. And it's not only far superior, it is in many ways distinctly different, even though there are points of similarity, such as the ox growing law. Notice what he says. This is page 24 of the citations. The superficial resemblance of Old Testament law to other law codes is undeniable. And it is instructive to ask, what might be the relationship between them? We have already seen that in Israel, it was God rather than the king who served as the lawgiver. This put the idea of law in a unique perspective. In one sense, all of Old Testament law was religious. Israel had a keen sense of this difference. Moses asks in Deuteronomy 4:8, what great nation is there that has statutes and ordinances so righteous as all this law? They knew that God, quote, has not dealt with thus with any other nation. Psalm 147:20. But at the same time, the similarities with neighboring law codes are also striking. These reflect not a wholesale borrowing, but, and these are the words of Roland DeVoe, who is a French Old Testament scholar, the influence of a single widespread customary law. In other words, there was a very widespread kind of customary legal tradition of that period of time. Let us examine the relationship in more detail. In the first place, because the law is to safeguard the covenant relationship, idolatry is severely condemned. And that's the first bullet up there on the screen. Idolatry is severely condemned. Exodus 20:23. Notice in 20:23, do not make any gods to be alongside of me. Do not make for yourselves gods of silver or gods of gold. And in 22:20, whoever sacrifices to any god other than Yahweh must be destroyed. So, idolatry is condemned. Secondly, life is respected. Look what Durness said. Life is seen as belonging to God. Going back to Genesis 9:5, man is made in the image of God. That sets man uniquely apart from other living creatures. So that when an ox kills a man, its flesh may not be eaten. Exodus 21:28 and 32. As a result, capital punishment is not nearly so common as it is in the case of the law code of Hammurabi. There, a wife that does not guard her property is cast into the river. Law 31. Robbery is punishable by death. Law 30. As is bearing false witness in a trial. Law 29. Indeed, in general, the punishment stipulated in the Old Testament shows a restraint of gross brutality. So, the second bullet, life is respected. Now, you know, there were a fair number of offenses for which life was to be demanded. There were capital offenses in the Old Testament, but much less so than we find in these other extra-biblical law codes. And thirdly, punishments show restraint. In general, there's much more restraint in the biblical law codes than in the extra-biblical law codes. And something that particularly stands out in connection with that is that there's no physical mutilation. I bring Hammurabi's code. If you look at the Hammurabi's code, Law 192, says, if the adopted son of a chamberlain or the adopted son of a votary has said to his foster father or foster mother, you are not my father, you are not my mother, what shall I do? They shall cut out his tongue. Mutilation. You know, that kind of tradition is still alive in some of the cultures of the Middle East. Law 193. If the adopted son of a chamberlain or the adopted son of a votary found out his parentage and came to hate his foster father and foster mother, and so is going off to his paternal home, what shall they do? They shall pluck out his eye. Law 205. If a senior slave has struck the cheek of a member of the aristocracy, they shall cut off his ear. Law 218. If a physician performed a major operation on a senior with a bronze lancet and has caused the senior's death, where he opened up the eye socket of the senior and has destroyed the senior's eye, they shall cut off his hand. So if you're a surgeon and you botch the job, you're liable to lose your hand. But that sort of thing of physical mutilation was pretty prominent in these ancient theories and cultures. You don't find that in the biblical warfare. Fourthly, class distinctions are not prominent. Middle of the page there in 24, Darnus says, in fact, the fact that all stood in the presence of God equally in the covenant relationship made it impossible for them to recognize a class distinction in their law. There is not one law for the free and another for slaves. Indeed, slaves come in for particular protection in the law against cruel and demanding masters. So class distinctions are not prominent. They are prominent in these other law codes. And slaves are protected against abuses. As Darnus goes on to say, by contrast, most of the Near Eastern law codes stipulate different punishments for a person dependent upon his station in life. Hammurabi's Code 203, if one of citizen status has struck the cheek of his equal, he shall pay a mina of silver. There's a small fine. But notice the next law. If the serf of a citizen has struck the cheek of one of citizen status, they shall cut off his ear. So you pay a fine if you're of higher social standing, you lose your ear if you are of a lower social standing. So slaves are protected against abuses, and then immorality is punished severely, and in connection with that, marriage is protected, regarded. Darnus says, because marriage is particularly important in God's sight and instituted by him, any infraction against chastity is severely punished. While promiscuity is punished in many ancient law codes, outside the Old Testament, there are exceptions that are authorized by the law. But in the Old Testament, if a slave is treated improperly, she is to be treated just as if she were a wife. Exodus 21:7-11. If a man seduces a virgin, she shall become his wife. Otherwise, adultery and fornication are punishable by death. The careful instructions in Leviticus about proper relations between a man and a woman are preceded by the warning that they are not to do as was done in Egypt, where they had been, nor as is done in Canaan, where they were going. You see, the practices of the Canaanites in the area of relationships between the sexes was radical from what you find in Leviticus. And the instructions close with the plea not to defile themselves by these practices, for I am Yahweh your God, Leviticus 18:30. Ultimately, then, even human relationships were to reflect God's character, and therefore were never to be understood only in terms of expediency. Unfaithfulness throughout the Old Testament was such an awful sin that God used it to illustrate the depths of Israel's unfaithfulness with himself. And that comes some of you are in the prophet's course of working on Hosea, where that theme is particularly prominent. And then finally, widows, fatherless strangers are protected. The weak of society are protected very clearly. And as Dernis says, specifically unique in Old Testament law are these numerous provisions for the stranger or alien, for those who are handicapped in one way or another. There were instructions for the blind and deaf, for widows and the fatherless, for the poor. Strangers or foreigners were singled out for protection from oppression, for it was explained you should understand the heart of a stranger since you were strangers in Egypt. God was especially concerned with the disadvantaged, with whom he says, with their cry to me, I will surely hear their cry. Exodus 22:22. One can almost hear Christ's words, blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Poverty is not considered a virtue in the Old Testament, but it is recognized how unjust the fallen order is, and those who are special victims of its injustice provide God's people with a heaven-sent opportunity to express the mercy of God himself. So if you look at 22, 21, and 22, just for an example, you read there, do not mistreat the alien or oppress him, for you were aliens in Egypt. Do not take advantage of a widow or an orphan. If you do, and they cry out to me, I will certainly hear their cry, my anger will be aroused, and I will kill you with the sword, your wives will become widows, your children fatherless. So, obviously, we take them very seriously. Widows and fatherless strangers were to be protected. So, you certainly see differences between the biblical law and the laws you find in those other ancient Near Eastern law codes. We've looked at some of the specific differences. If you generalize, I think you can say, in general, there's a difference in religious spirit. There's a high degree of humanitarian concern. And the legal terminology as well as order and content differ. So, even though there are points in the covenant code where you see a reflection of the legal tradition of that particular period of time and culture, these differences are so prominent that I think it's quite clear that there's no direct borrowing from the extra-biblical law codes that's involved in the composition of the Book of the Covenant or the formulation of the laws of the Book of the Covenant. There are many laws that do not find a parallel in the extra-biblical law codes. So I think the conclusion to draw about this question, what is the relationship between the Book of the Covenant and other ancient Near Eastern law codes, is that there is a relationship, but it's indirect rather than direct. And I think the point of Exodus 21:1, these are the laws you are to set before them, is that these are the laws that God desired his people to have at this particular point in time as they are being established as his covenant people. The Book of the Covenant is unique in its divine authority and in its plan, but at the same time, it's rooted in the legal concepts of the day in which it was given. And I think that's what we find generally with the way in which God speaks to his people, he comes to them in the language, thought forms, ideas, institutions with which they were familiar, and these laws are no different in that respect from many other institutions that you find in Israel. Questions or comments? Yeah? You know, I think that there, that's not to be taken literally. I think the point that's being made is that the penalty for a given offense should be commensurate with the severity of the offense. In other words, there's to be an equality in the severity of the penalty with the severity of the offense. An eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. It's not like you. Like Hammurabi's code, somebody does something insignificant and he loses his ear or his eye or his head. There's a disparity between the penalty and the offense.
So how would they deal with accidental?
Usually for accidental, even accidental death. There's no penalty for that. The accidental death is legislated in the biblical material. And for accidental death, the death penalty was not enforced. It's premeditated murder for which it is enforced. Well, generally there would be some kind of a fine, but there wouldn't be, say somebody injured, somebody else's eye. We take it literally, for example. We wouldn't take the other guy's eye for it. We'd pay a fine and do something of that sort. But there wouldn't be a physical mutilation. Any other question? All right, let's go on to Ed. The covenant formally ratified in chapter 24, 1 to 11. After the presentation of this material, you read, let me start reading in verse 3. When Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded with one voice, "Everything the Lord has said, we will do." Moses then wrote down everything the Lord had said. He got up early the next morning, built an altar at the foot of the mountain, and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent young Israelite men, and they offered burnt offerings, sacrificed young bulls as fellowship offerings to the Lord. Moses took half of the blood and put it in bowls, and the other half he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the Book of the Covenant. We ask, why is this material from 20 to 23 called the Book of the Covenant? The title or the label really comes from verse 7. He took the Book of the Covenant. He took this legal material and read it to the people. They responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey." Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, "This is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, the 70 elders of Israel, went up and saw the God of Israel. Under his feet was something like a pavement made of sapphire, clear as the sky itself. But God did not raise his hand against these leaders of the Israelites. They saw God, and they ate and they drank. Now this is covenant ratification. And you get the key elements of a covenant ratification ceremony that appear in this description of Exodus 24, 3-11. You have a covenant document mentioned in verse 4 and verse 7. Moses wrote down everything the Lord said, 7. He read it to the people. You have covenant stipulations referred to, verse 3, who told the people all the Lord's words and laws. And you have the covenant oath in verse 3 and verse 7, where the people say, everything the Lord has said, we will do. Notice that the oath is taken by the people. The oath is not taken by the Lord himself. The people are the ones who swear the oath. That brings up the difference that has been observed and often written about between what's called a promise covenant and a law covenant. I may have mentioned this earlier. But in a promise covenant, such as the Abrahamic covenant or the Davidic covenant, God makes the promise and God takes the oath. If you go back to the ratification of the Abrahamic covenant, you have a description of that in Genesis chapter 15. And in that chapter you have, I think I did mention this last week, that smoking fiery furnace that moves between the slain heads of the animals, in which the Lord is taking what Meredith Klein has called a self-maledictory oath. So be it done to me if I do not fulfill the promise which I have made to you. In a law covenant, it's the people who take it. And in this case, the Sinai covenant is a law covenant. And it's the Israelites who swear to do all that the Lord has required of them. The only thing I want to call your attention to here is the sprinkling of the blood. There's religious ceremony, including sacrifices and sprinkling of blood. Look at your citations, page 27, on the sprinkling of the blood. This is from J. Motier. He said, the blood moves first Godward in propitiation, but then secondly, manward. And he took the book of the covenant and read in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do and be obedient. Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people. First he took it and sprinkled it on the altar, but then on the people. On what people did he sprinkle it? At what precise moment did that sprinkling of blood occur? At the moment when they committed themselves to a life of obedience. They had said, all that the Lord has said, we will do. First comes the commitment to obedience according to the Lord. All that the Lord has said, we will do, we will be obedient. Then the sprinkling of the blood manward. What does that mean? It means that just as the blood of the covenant on the one hand establishes the relationship of peace with God by propitiation, so, on the other hand, the blood of the covenant maintains the relationship of peace with God for a people who are committed to walk in obedience. God knows that the people are professing beyond their strength. They have well said in what they have said. This is from Deuteronomy, where Moses reflects back on this, where the people say, all that the Lord has said we will do. And in Deuteronomy 5:28, the Lord says, they have well said in what they have said. Oh, that there were such a heart in them that they would keep all my commandments always. In other words, it wasn't wrong for them to say that we will do this, but the Lord knew very well that they would fall short. They are professing beyond their ability. Very well, says God. I will make a provision for them. The same blood which has made peace with God will keep peace with God. As they walk in the way of obedience, the blood is available for the people committed to obey. As they stumble and fall, so the covenant blood will be available for them. So you get a covenant ratification ceremony here, including these elements that are characteristic of such covenant ratification ceremony. Any questions, comments?
No. Back to the previous comment. Are you saying an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth is not to be literal
That's the way I understand it. I understand it as simply a requirement that punishments be equitable to severity of the crime.
Yeah. Where you
Can anybody give me the reference of where that is? Is it in Leviticus? Exodus? Oh, I see. Okay. Well, maybe it occurs somewhere else in a different context where what I have been saying seems to flow. In this context, what you were suggesting earlier seems to fit.
I'll go to Leviticus 24.
Is it Leviticus 24?
Deuteronomy 19.
Leviticus 24, you know the verses there?
24 to
20. Okay, well that looks the same as the Exodus, actually. What's the Deuteronomy reference?
Deuteronomy 19 and 20.
That brings up I grant in those cases, it seems like in the context, you go back to verse 22 of Exodus 21, where if men who are fighting hit a pregnant woman, she gives birth prematurely, there's no serious injury. The offender must be fined whatever the woman's husband demands for the matter. But if there is serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand. I don't know. I think it's still possible to take it the way I was suggesting, although I granted it's not altogether clear there. This comes up in Sermon on the Mount somewhere. What is that? Do they have that reference?
Matthew 5:38.
You see, there, it's you have heard it was said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. But, and Jesus says, I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn around the other also. Someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go a mile, go with him too. In other words, someone hits you, don't hit him back. Someone breaks your arm, you don't break his arm. That you have heard in the Sermon on the Mount, if you go through all of those, seems often the reference is not to something that was inherently in the law, but rather the traditions that have grown up around the application of the law. So, you know, if you go back to Exodus 21, 22, and 23, and particularly verse 23, I think it's still possible that the point being made there is equivalence in the penalty rather than the literal eye for eye for tooth for tooth. Man hits his manservant. Compensate for it. Yeah. All right. Now let's. That was I was just glancing at it again and haven't seen it going further to the following context. That seems to argue for the concept of equivalence in severity of penalty as compared to the severity of offense, but not the relation.
If you can figure out that I literally still more equitable than the other law,
Well, to reflect on that, I think I'm still inclined. I haven't looked at this for a time, and I was fuzzy on the exact context of that, but I still think the point of it is equivalent, more so than it's literal.
Any other comments?
It's 1-2. This is sort of a parenthetical discussion that I'm inserting here because I think it's the fitting place to discuss it. And that is the subject of ancient Near Eastern vassal treaties and the Sinai Covenant. That is a rather large issue that has a lot of implications. So I want to kind of work through it with you. The whole idea of comparing the biblical covenant materials with ancient Near Eastern international treaties, which is something today that is quite common in the literature, was a new idea in 1954 when George Mendenhall published some articles in the Biblical Archaeologist entitled Law and Covenant in Israel and the Ancient Near East. That article is in your bibliography if you look under this heading in your bibliography. The basic idea of Mendenhall's article was that there were striking parallels to be observed between the literary genre of the biblical covenant and the literary genre of certain ancient Near Eastern treaties, particularly those of the Hittite Empire. And that idea was a new idea, and it's that article is one of these unusual kind of articles that's seminal in the sense that it produced a whole field of study. And there are books and articles in the second half of the 20th century that came out of Mendenhall's calling attention to the literary structural similarity between certain Hittite treaties and the biblical covenant. Those Hittite treaties have been around for years. They were uncovered in the early 1900s, many of them published in the 1920s, 1930s. People looked at them, were aware of their contents, but nobody had noticed the structural parallel between the Hittite treaties and the literary structure of the biblical covenant material. So here was a new field of study. Let's go to A, the Hittite treaties. The Hittite treaties come from what's called the New Hittite Empire and were documents formulated during the reigns of those five kings. They're interesting names. Supiolionis, Marcellus, Muwatallis, that really should be M-U instead of M-O, Muwatallis, Hattusilus, and Futhalius. The treaties can be divided into two groups or types. Some are called vassal treaties. And the others heritage treaties. That should be an A, not an E. A vassal treaty which is the most common form is a treaty between a superior and an inferior party. Sometimes a vassal treaty is called a suzerain treaty. suzerain was the great king of the Hittite Empire. He was the superior partner to the treaty arrangement. The vassal was the inferior partner. In a suzerain or vassal treaty, where you have this disparity between the two partners to the treaty, it's only the inferior party who is bound by oath to the stipulations of the treaty agreement. So the vassal takes the oath. As I said, the vassal or suzerainty treaty is the most common form of treaty coming from this period of time. But there were a couple of examples of what's called a parity treaty. The best example is one between Ramesses II and Phutasilas III. You see, he's the fourth one there. Now, Ramesses II is that Ramesses of the 19th dynasty in Egypt that we talked about in connection with the late Hebrew Exodus. And Ramesses took an army, I think I mentioned that, up and fought with the Hittites way up in Syria on the Orontes River. And it was a standoff. Neither one could really achieve a decisive victory. And what they did at the conclusion of that battle was sign a parity treaty as equals. And in a parity treaty, both partners take the oath. And they agreed not re-engage in battle again. They accepted that Egypt had its own area there to the south, and the Hittites had their area to the north, and they came to a non-aggression pact, is really what it was, a parity treaty. Now, it's with the suzerain vassal treaties that you find the parallel with the biblical covenantship. The purpose of a suzerain vassal treaty, according to Mendenhall in that article in 1954, was, quote, to establish a firm relationship of mutual support between the two parties, in which the interests of the Hittite sovereign were primary and ultimate concern. In other words, there's a sense in which this treaty is imposed. The Hittite sovereign is the sovereign, and it's really his interests that are being guarded and protected by the stipulations of this treaty. The treaty is what's called unilateral. That is, it's only the inferior partner that is bound by oath. And because of that, it meant that the vassal had to have a fairly large degree of trust in the Hittite suzerain, that the Hittite suzerain would do what he promised to do, and that then the vassal would have the obligation to live up to the stipulations that the suzerain placed upon him. And if you read these treaties, you find that this idea of trust between the vassals of the Hittite great kings was something that was common, and it was not unfounded, because the Hittite great kings had done benevolent things for the vassal. In other words, the Hittite king had treated the vassal in positive ways, done good things for him. So it wasn't a blind trust, but a trust based on past experience of the protective and helpful hand of the Hittite ruler. Let's go to the treaty form. There are about 16 or 18 Hittite treaties that have been found. And if you look at the literary pattern that characterizes them, you will find that they followed that outline that you see up there on the screen. There are six basic elements in the literary pattern of the Hittite suzerain vassal treaties. There's a preamble. I want to say something about each of these elements in a minute. But a preamble, a historical prologue, and then a basic stipulation, followed by detailed stipulations, followed by witnesses, and then blessings and curses. Now, with the preamble, you have the names and the titles of the Hittite ruler. In other words, the preamble identifies the author of the treaty. The name and the titles of the Hittite ruler. That's followed by a historical prologue. And I think we can say that the historical prologue is probably the most significant element in the structure of the treaty form. And the reason for that is that it sets the tone and the spirit for the treaty relationship. What the historical prologue does is give a resume of the previous relationship between the great king and the vassal. And what is emphasized is the benevolent acts of the great king toward the vassal in the past. In other words, the Hittite king will say, I've done this and this and this for you. It becomes clear that this is not just some sort of stereotyped formula that's just attached to all the treaties that the great kings of the Hittite Empire make, because all the historical prologues are different and they're specific. And they're regarded by people who have studied them as resumes that contain valid historical information. Some of them are very lengthy and detailed, some of them are very short, but they describe events in the past involving the two treaty partners, and they perform the function of making the case for both gratitude and trust and sense of obligation for the vassal toward the great king. In other words, the great king says, I've done this and this for you. And then when you move down into the stipulations, now here, this is what I expect of you. The vassal has a reason to trust the great king because he was helped him in the past, but he also has an obligation toward the great king because of what the great king has done in the past. So that historical prologue has a very important function in setting up the spirit, you might say, of the relationship between these two partners. And it flows quite naturally into the third element of the treaty form. And the third element is what's called a basic stipulation, sometimes a statement of substance. That's a rather brief general clause that summarizes the obligation of loyalty on the part of the minor treaty partner toward the great king. The fundamental obligation of loyalty. In one of the treaties after the historical prologue, this is a treaty from Marcellus with a vassal king by the name of Dupitessa. The name there is not important. But that basic stipulation reads, now keep the oaths of the king and protect the power of the king. There's your obligation, your fundamental obligation. Keep these oaths, protect the power of the great king. From another of the treaties, also by Marsilius with another individual from Ugarit, he says, you, Nicmipa, which is the name of the vassal king, from now on into the days of the future, you shall be faithful to the king of Hatti, that is the king of the Hittites. In days to come, keep this pact of friendship with the king of Hatti, the sons of the king, and with Hatti. So this statement of the fundamental obligation of loyalty on the part of the vassal toward the great king, which flows out of the historical prologue, where the beneficent and benevolent acts of the great king toward the vassal have been enumerated. And then that's followed by the detailed stipulations in the fourth section of the treaty. And there you get, rather than a general statement of obligation of loyalty, specific things that are expected of the vassal. Prohibition of other foreign relationships. The vassal must not permit any evil words against the great king. The vassal is to appear before the Hittite king once a year, bringing annual tribute. Controversies between vassals are to be submitted to the great king for judgment. And on and on and on. Detailed kinds of stipulations are the kinds of things that the great king expected of the vassal. That is followed by a listing of gods as witnesses. The gods who are enumerated are the gods of the Hittites, that is, of the great king, as well as the gods of the vassal. And usually these lists are quite lengthy. And it's the deities who will ensure that this is a binding document, which flows naturally into number 6, the blessings and the curses. If you obey your obligations, you will enjoy the blessings of these deities. If you disobey the stipulations, the basic and detailed stipulations, you will then experience the curses of these various deities. So the gods are the enactors, you might say, of the curses and the blessings. Usually the curses are given first, followed by the blessings. The curses include such things as sterility, poverty, plague, famine, misery, things of those sort. The blessings are continuity of the vassal's line. That was always an issue, you know, who is going to succeed on the throne. Health, prosperity, peace, things of that sort. So that's the structure of the Hittite treaties. Mendenhall, way back in 1954, when he wrote the original article that pointed this structure out, he also said that in some of the treaties, not all of them, that structure is consistent in all the treaties. But in some of the treaties, you have references to a few other things. And these are additional features. A formal oath pledged by the vassal, a ratification ceremony, a form for procedure against a rebellious vassal, and fourth, provision for deposit of the treaty document in the vassal sanctuary with periodic public reading. And in some of the treaties, you have references to some of those items as well. Now, that is the form of the treaties. C on your outline is the Hittite treaties of the second millennium BC differ in form from later treaties. And when I speak here of later treaties, I'm thinking particularly of 7th century Assyrian treaties from the time of Esarhaddon and 8th century Aramaic treaties that come from Syria. So the Hittite treaties have a different form from a body of treaties that come along in the 7th and 8th centuries BC. When you look at the when you look at the treaties here of Sapiri, that's the Aramaic treaties, and the Assyrian treaties of Esarhaddon. This chart here is adapted from Dave Kitchen's article on Biblical Archaeology Review. Here's the structure: title, witnesses, stipulations, curses of the Assyrian treaties. Sapiri treaties, title, witnesses, curses, stipulations. You compare that with the Hittite treaty and the biblical covenant materials, where you have title, prologue, stipulations, deposit, witnesses, blessing, curses. You see, there's a different structure. And the striking thing about both the Assyrian and the Aramaic treaties of the 7th and 8th centuries is that there is no historical prologue. See, there's no historical prologue. Here you have a historical prologue. Here there's none. You have the title, the author of the treaty, witnesses, and curses. Title, witnesses, stipulation, curses. What that means is you have a very harsh tone in particularly the Assyrian treaty. The wording is the ruthless imposition of Assyrian power over some vassal state. There's no hint of any benevolent or merciful actions on the part of the Assyrian ruler toward the vassal in the previous relationship. There's no basis for trust. There's nothing that would merit loyalty and thankfulness, gratitude toward the great king. What you find here is a declaration of obligations imposed on the vassal with horrible curses if the vassal doesn't obey those obligations. And then you notice there are no blessings. It's only curses. So you see, if you look at the Hittite structure, where you have that historical prologue that describes the benevolent actions of the great king toward the vassal, and that includes blessings as well as curses, you have an entirely different tone or spirit in the relationship between the treaty partners. Now, having said that, let me go back. You notice on your outline, C was the Hittite treaties differ in form from these later treaties. But D is the treaties in the biblical covenant. If you look at that Hittite structure and then look at the biblical covenant materials, there are various evangelical scholars who have worked with this, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, and you can debate exactly how to lay this out. But I've used here K.A. Kitchen and J.A. Thompson. You can look in their bibliographies for their writings. When you come to the biblical material, the covenant, of course, is established at Sinai. That's where we are in the book of Exodus. We're at Sinai. That covenant was renewed 40 years later after the wilderness wandering on the plains of Moab, the book of Deuteronomy is really a covenant renewal document. It seems that covenants, being particularly concerned with succession in leadership, were typically renewed at the point of a change in leadership. Moses is at the point of his death when you come to the plains of Moab. And therefore, part of the reason for the renewal of the covenant at that point in time was to provide for the transition of leadership from Moses to Joshua. You get there what some have called dynastic succession. And when a vassal's leader died and you had a succession, there would be a renewal of the treaty with the great king. So here you have Moses and Joshua, and there's a lot of attention given to that succession if you read carefully through Deuteronomy. It's appropriate to have a covenant renewal ceremony. You come to the end of the book of Joshua, Joshua chapter 24. Joshua is at the point of death, and he gathers all Israel to Shechem. And there Israel again renews their allegiance to the Lord at a point of transition of leadership from Joshua into the period of the judges. I think the purpose of these renewals was to provide for covenant continuity through a period of transition in leadership. So you have the covenant established in Exodus, renewed in the book of Deuteronomy, renewed in Joshua 24, the point of the death of Joshua. The next covenant renewal is 1 Samuel 11 and 12, where at the time of the transition from the judges to the monarchy, a major transition in the structure of the leadership of the theocracy. Their kingship is established in the concept, in the context of a covenant renewal ceremony that time held at Gilgal. So you can look at Exodus, you can look at Deuteronomy, you can look at Joshua 24, you can look at 1 Samuel 12, and what you find is that those elements of the Hittite treaty form appear rather clearly in all of those biblical materials. Now, what Kitchen and Thompson here have done is take those elements, preamble. Kitchen finds it in Exodus 21 for the Exodus passage. Thompson in Exodus 19, 3, 20, verse 2a. In Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 1, 1 to 5. In Joshua 24, Joshua 24, 2. And so on with the historical prologue, the basic stipulation, the detailed stipulations, the witnesses, the curses and the blessings. You notice with witnesses, a difference here is we don't have deities as witnesses. In 24:4, what is that of Exodus? Moses wrote down everything the Lord said. He got up early the next morning, built an altar at the foot of the mountain, set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. There was the witnesses, the 12 stone pillars. If you go to Joshua 24:27, for example, you read, "See," he said to all the people, "this stone will be a witness against it, us. It has heard all the words the Lord has said to you. It will be a witness against you if you are untrue to your God." In Deuteronomy, Moses calls heaven and earth as witness to the treaty that Israel has made with the Lord. So you have witnesses, you have curses and blessings. So the thing that, get back to Mendenhall's original article, the thing that Mendenhall called attention to was the structure of the Hittite treaty, and then the reflections of very similar structure in the biblical covenant material. Now, Meredith Klein, who is an evangelical that's done, or did a lot of work on the analogy between the Hittite treaty materials and biblical covenant materials, wrote a book called The Treaty of the Great King. And that book was a discussion of this analogy between the Hittite treaties and the biblical covenant materials, but at the same time, a commentary on the book of Deuteronomy. And when he gives the title to that book, The Treaty of the Great King, he is saying, in essence, Deuteronomy is a covenant document. It is the Treaty of the Great King. The Great King is Yahweh. And he outlines Deuteronomy, I think, legitimately in a way that reflects the treaty structure. So there's a preamble, historical prologue, stipulations, a great commandment, ancillary commandments, more detailed ones, sanctions, covenant ratification, including blessings and curses within that material, and then dynastic disposition, covenant continuity. That's the transition in leadership between Moses and Joshua. And Klein, I think, did a good job in showing how Deuteronomy reflects the treaty form. Now, what he does beyond that in his book, Treaty of the Great King, is point out some of the implications that flow from the similarity of the Hittite treaty form and the biblical covenant materials. Look at your citations, page 28. Paragraph A. He says the position to be advocated here is that Deuteronomy is a covenant renewal document, which in its total structure exhibits the classic legal form of the suzerainty treaties of the Mosaic Age. In light of the evidence now surveyed, it would seem indisputable that the book of Deuteronomy, not in the form of some imaginary original core, but precisely in the integrity of its present form, the only one for which there is any objective evidence, exhibits the structure of the ancient suzerainty treaties and the unity and completeness of their classic pattern. Now, you notice he's talking about Deuteronomy in its present form. In other words, the structure of the entirety of the book, rather than in the form of some imaginary original core. It's been typical of critical scholars for the past century to say that Deuteronomy is a late composition and that its original core was chapters 12 to 26, and then chapters 1 to 11 were added later, 27 to 34 were added later, and all of it was much later in the time of Moses. Now, what you see Klein is saying is Deuteronomy reflects a literary structure in its total composition, not in some original core with added material at its beginning and at its end, but as an original composition. He says that there should be a measure of oratorical literary enrichment of the traditional legal form as natural, considering the caliber of the author and the grandeur of the occasion. Now, of course, there is the conceptual adaptation inevitable in the adoption of common formal media for the expression of the unique revelation of God in scriptures. In other words, the Hittite treaty form is not just transposed in some kind of mechanical way into the material to run. There's certain freedom with which that form is used. And of course, there's an enormous difference between some human king imposing a treaty on a vassal and God entering into a covenant relationship with his people. So there are some differences, but the general structure is the same. And he concludes with the statement, what is remarkable is the detailed extent to which God has utilized this legal instrument of human kingdoms for the definition and administration of his own redemptive reign over his people. In other words, here's another example of how God speaks in the legal forms of the time in which this revelation was given, in which the covenant was established. He uses something that was familiar to the people of that time in order to structure the relationship between himself and his people. Now, Klein works out further some of the implications of this. The first is an implication for the date of Deuteronomy. Look at paragraph B, the bottom of page 28 in your citations. The implication of the new evidence for the questions of the antiquity and authenticity of Deuteronomy must not be suppressed. The kind of document with which Deuteronomy has been identified did not originate in some recurring ritual situation. These treaties were, of course, prepared for particular historical occasions. It is necessary, therefore, to seek for an appropriate historical episode in the national life of Israel in order to account satisfactorily for the origin of the Deuteronomic Treaty. Without now rehearsing all the data that make it perfectly apparent that the addressees were the recently founded theocratic nation, we would press only one question. Where, either in monarchic or pre-monarchic times, except in the very occasion to which Deuteronomy traces itself, can an historical situation be found in which the 12 tribes would have been summoned to a covenant engagement whose peculiar purpose was, as to the purpose of the Deuteronomic Treaty demonstrably was, to guarantee the continuance of a non-Davidic dynasty over Israel. In other words, see this, the issue of dynastic succession from Moses to Joshua. And that's an important element in the book of Deuteronomy. Where else would this fit other than at the end of Moses' life? So he says it has an implication for the date. It also has implications for the manner in which this material was transmitted down through time. But I'm skipping ahead. I should have finished reading the top page 29. Let's do that. We're still talking about date before we're talking about transmission. That next paragraph, the top of page 29, another index of the time of Deuteronomy's composition is provided by the evolution of the documentary form of suzerainty treaties. Admittedly, the available evidence is still quite limited. The differences among the extant treaties are not to be exaggerated. It's indeed one species we meet throughout Old Testament times. Nevertheless, there is a discernible evolution. This concerns those diagrams. For example, where the beginning is preserved in the first millennium treaties of Sapphira and Nimrod, it is not the opening Ummah of the second millennium BC Hittite treaties or its equivalent. Also in the Sapphira treaties, only a trace remains of the blessing sanction. The most remarkable difference is the historical prologue is no longer found in the later texts. We've talked about that a minute ago. So his next paragraph, he says, while it is necessary to recognize a substantial continuity and pattern between the early and later treaties, it is proper to distinguish the Hittite treaties of the second millennium as the classic form. And without any doubt, the book of Deuteronomy belongs to the classic stage in this documentary evolution. Here, then, is significant confirmation of the prima facie case for the Mosaic origin of the Deuteronomic Treaty of the Great King. See, what he's arguing there is, if you look at the structure of treaties from the third millennium down to the first millennium, You can go for 2,000 years. The structure of the Hittite treaties, which he calls the classic form of the treaty, this structure here, is what parallels the biblical treaty with church. If you go back to the 3rd millennium BC, structure's quite different. So if you go early, it's different. If you go later, it's different. I think there's, you know, I said there are 16, 18 Hittite treaties. There are about 85 treaties recovered over a period of 2,000 years. And if you look at them, you'll see the structure differs through time. The biblical material corresponds to the Hittite form. The Hittite form dates to the Mosaic era, 1400s, 1200s. You go later, the traditional argument of critical scholars is that Deuteronomy was written in the 6th or 7th century, late in Israel's history. Usually, the origin of Deuteronomy has been said to be the time of Josiah, 621 BC, when the law book was found in the temple by Hilkiah the priest, and he takes it to Josiah. And the traditional critical view is that law book was Deuteronomy. It was represented as being Mosaic, but it wasn't. It was written by the religious leaders of Jerusalem with the purpose of centralizing worship in Jerusalem in the time of Josiah. So the Deuteronomy is late. There's an almost unanimous consensus in critical scholars. Deuteronomy is to be dated in 621 BC. And what Klein is saying is, if you look at the literary form of the book of Deuteronomy, that form is rooted back in the 12 to 1400s, the time of Moses, time of the Hittite kings, not in the time of the Esarhaddon treaties, but the 7th century BC. So those are implications for date. I said then there are also implications for the manner of transmission.